In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Alex. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. But you know what? You know, you thought I'd jumped the gun on Christmas a couple of weeks ago.
You did ask, but okay, yes, go on.
Now the paper is full of it.
Yep. And now it's official.
You're going to tell us what's in the paper and how Christmassy it is, etc.
It's about to be December. So, yes, now we've got a bumper issue, actually, for the podcast and in the paper. This week's issue is Christmas books, so it's got lots of fun stuff in. It's got the evolution of Godzilla. It's got the history of the pocket calculator. It's got a roundup of children's books, including Catherine Rundle, who we've talked about quite a bit. It's got a very crucial piece on what it means to come from Yorkshire, which I
did. You write that?
No, I didn't. No. I read it with very close attention. It's a very good piece. And then the smaller.
What does it mean to come from Yorkshire?
Well, I can't tell you that, Alex, because then it will ruin it. You have to
read the piece. Okay. Is this deliberately this week? Because wasn't Lancashire Day this week?
Was it? No, I don't know if that's on purpose, but if it is, it's brilliant.
Well, there you are.
There's one very good aside in the piece when he just says he's not being very tub thumping about it. But at one point he says,
who's written it?
It's Richard Smith with a Y, who I think we've talked to before.
We have.
And he just says at one point, it's something like, this would be a good book for people from Yorkshire and other worse places. He just puts it in as an aside. It's beautiful.
My goodness. Do you know, I do know somebody from Yorkshire and their refrain is, you can't beat Yorkshire. We've even got our own dog.
Well, but loads of places have got their own dog.
Oh, I suppose so. Anyway,
as well as Yorkshire, there's the smaller and less important matter of the purpose of the universe. So that's sorted out this week in the TLS. We've also got a letter from a really wonderful, very versatile, very distinguished actor on the letters page. Just saying.
Oh, and you're not going to say who it
I'm
is,
I'm absolutely
are you?
Not going to say who it is, no.
You'll have to read the paper.
Subscribe to the TLS, dear listeners, and then get this bumper issue with all its wonderful stuff in it.
Well, that sounds extraordinary, full of stuff, as is this podcast. So we're actually going to hurry on because this week, Toby Lischtig and I got to talk to the newest booker on the block, Paul Lynch, whose novel Prophet Song has just won this year's prize. And we have Emily Copley on the fascination of Virginia Woolf's diaries. But first, Paul Lynch's fifth novel, Prophet Song, lays out a stark proposition. A man detained by the state on charges unelaborated and unfounded, a woman desperately trying to keep her four children and her elderly father safe from harm as their country slides into authoritarianism, a city divided, watchful and terrified. This is the Dublin of Lynch's imagination, but the scenario it describes is far from unimaginable. It's happened before, it's happening now, and will doubtless happen in the future. It was the depth of this vision that saw Lynch this week carrying off the Booker Prize, and we're delighted that he was able to join me and Toby Lischtig. Paul, so many congratulations. You gave an extremely powerful speech when you collected the award, telling people that the book had been really, really hard to write. I mean, I can imagine why it was, but tell us in your own words, why was it and how did it start for you, Prophet Song?
Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody willingly goes into this universe, and yet that's the sort of world that I'm kind of drawn to as a writer. I think that I have a responsibility to the reader too, that even though I found this book hugely challenging to write, that I must take the hand of the reader as Virgil does to Dante. And I have a responsibility for them too, that through poetry and perhaps maybe some smidgen of grace, that I can take them into this world and allow them to stare at the abyss without falling in. And that's the thing about why it was hard to write the book, is because I had to go to places that were really challenging for me. The penultimate chapter of the book, I couldn't even write it for months. It was looming before me. I knew what I had to do. I didn't know how to do it. I was petrified of how I was going to do it, what it would do to the reader, if I had the technique, the ability, the grace to pull it off without, you know, as they say, losing the reader. But the key thing was the sense of truth that I had to follow, that the book has a very distinct line of truth. And I saw the truth in the book as a series of equations, this because of this, because of this, because of this, all the way to the last line of the book, in which it's the QED, so to speak. And so I also had some personal challenges. I mean, it was COVID for everybody for a period of time while I was writing the book. I had a son born just before I started writing the book. I had long COVID for the best part of a year, which was chronic fatigue and brain fog in waves. It would come and it would go. And so it was just a challenge, and financially challenging as well, because COVID was a wrecking ball for so many writers. I look back now and I kind of recognize that the period of my life in which I wrote this book wasn't a happy one. And that's not reflected in the book. Like, the book is a separate thing, but I suppose we sort of disappear into the writing a lot. But when I look back at that period of my life, it was a hard time, you know, and yeah. And that's the calling. I think you just have to turn up and do the work, and, you know, you do what's required of you, what the story is asking. And, you know, that's my job. That's my calling, I think.
I mean, that final part of it was relentless. And, well, you did lose this reader, and I can't imagine losing readers because you're just sucked into it. And I wonder, you say it kind of built up before you. How did it come out of you when you finally could write it?
It came out of me in two ways. One, I would say it came out in this sort of flood because I had sort of figured out how to do it. I actually wrote an essay about this a couple of years ago during lockdown. I had a dream that just gave me the coordinates for that final section of the book, and also gave me the coordinates for the essay to write about it, because I had been commissioned to write something and didn't know what to write. It was a public lecture that I had to give for The Stinging Fly. And so it came out of me in a torrent, but the reason it had that it had the flow that it had was the structure of the language had been so carefully built up. Those cadences, those long passages, those long sentences, that sense of inevitability that's built into the language, all that was sort of there as a channel, and it was built to take the flood when it came, and that's what happened.
There is this sense of things unfolding at this torrid pace, which I think the kind of the writing really, really reflects. And was, did you set out to write like that, or did you just find that happened naturally?
Yeah, I mean, writing is a deeply intuitive act, and you're sort of standing in the river as it's passing through you, and you're trying to steer it in some way, shape, or form. And that's by doing that, you give the novel its form and you find the weave. And part of that weave that you put together, you know, you ask yourself questions about the meaning of the text, the meaning at the sort of secret center of the book, and the form must answer to that. And so when I make decisions about how, you know, you mentioned the paragraphs, and I make decisions like that, they sort of often come upon me intuitively because I realize that it's speaking towards the meaning of the book. And I think it's very important. I think this is important because, you know, there's a lot of remodernism going on in the fiction. And I do notice that it's the case sometimes that there's no justification for certain things that have been taken out. I pay attention to that and I'll think about it and I go, I can't quite see a reason for this. So this is just perhaps pretentiousness. But in my own case, everything has a justification, at least for me anyway. And, you know, it became clear to me that Ailish just has nowhere to turn in this book, that she's just carried onwards endlessly in this sort of this rush of events, but it also has a sort of great metaphysical blindness to it. Like she's in, you could consider it a labyrinth, or, you know, there's a sense of Greek tragedy at play in my own thinking, that how we're constantly beset by, you know, life, and we have to make choices and we act with certainty, but we just reap a crop of the unforeseen. And I'm really interested in this, how life is blind to us. And yet we're just so certain. We're so damn certain all the time. And Ailish is trying to make all these decisions, but she's straitjacketed at the same time. And so I want the reader to feel that. I want them to completely feel that sense of claustrophobia and all the undertow that's going on in the text.
You've just unlocked something in the novel for me with that mention of Greek tragedy, because the thing that I found so incredibly strong about the book was its sort of realism, its descriptive realism, and some of that in the mundane detail of life in the household, which of course is, you know, partly familiar to us from things like lockdown. And then this sense of enormous choices being made. And she is such a complex character. She doesn't want her husband to fall foul of the authorities, but then she urges him to stand with his conscience. And then she has this huge survival instinct, but sometimes we think she's denying what's going on, denying what's happening. I was really interested in you making her, rather than her husband Larry, the central point of view in the novel.
Yeah, you know, if you take a book like The Iliad, which is full of male heroics, and, you know, it's full of the foreground is the event, and you turn it inside out and you shake it, well, you're going to be left with the life, the humdrum, the people in the background who are trying to make sense of the enormity of the events that they're being impacted by. You maybe arrive at Ailish, and I will say Larry too. I mean, he could have been a part of this book. He was a part of this book until he was arrested. But the book is deeply interested in the humdrum. You know, there's a line in it, the life is lived in the humdrum, and our happiness is found in the humdrum. And that's really important to me, that you know, people keep calling this book dystopian. And I'm like, really? Do you think it is? Because I'm just really not so sure about that. And then when you deepen realism to such a degree as I do in this book, I think that the dystopian sort of falls away to a certain extent. I mean, I would throw in just as an aside here that anything that seems to be speculative cannot be speculative if it's happening somewhere in the world right now. It was really important for me to enter into the feeling of events, the hidden life of unrecorded acts, that sense of the heartbeat of the moment. And that's where life is. And that's where you can truly connect the reader to what's unfolding, and at which point it ceases to be something that might be like journalism and it becomes truly fiction.
I completely see what you're saying about dystopia, because Toby, I don't know about you, I didn't read it as dystopian or speculative at all.
The whole point is that absolutely everything that happens in this book has happened, and, you know, as Paul said, is probably happening somewhere, someplace. It reminds me a bit of a book that's also regularly called Dystopia, The Handmaid's Tale, which is a very, very different book, but Margaret Atwood said of it, the point of this book is that there's nothing in this book has not happened at some point in time. And in a similar way, this is a book about what happens when populism emerges and fascism descends on a state, and when war tears people apart. I mean, this is how people react. This is what people have to go through. And one of the things that really struck me as I was finishing it, in many ways, this is a book about parenting, I thought. This is a book about parenting in extreme conditions. And Ailish's relationship with her four children, all at different stages of their childhood, is so beautifully done and described and thought through. And I think that's one of the most powerful things about it for me. Is that something you were very conscious of, Paul? Or maybe that's the wrong question, because you know.
Yeah, I'm very interested in how we are sort of metamorphically changed by the events that we live through. And I'm felt it necessary to pay great attention to the children in the book and how the disappearance of their father affects them all differently, and to how those changes sort of manifest throughout the story. And those changes, you know, they're horrific changes in this, for each of them in all different kinds of ways. You know, the impact on their psychology is, as innocence is enormous, and I'm interested in that, you know. And for Bailey becomes really changed and hardened, and his relationship with his mother sours enormously because she chooses not to tell him that his father has been disappeared. She lies about it, and that decision really sets in chain a sequence of events between them that's very unfortunate. Molly begins to withdraw into herself. She just processes it in a way that's alienates her mother, and Eilish doesn't know how to reach her anymore. And then Mark, the eldest, well, he just becomes radicalized. This is what happens. He becomes the next radicalized generation, and he gets swallowed by it. And meantime, then, you know, those scenes where they're living through airstrikes, and Eilish recognizes what's going into the body of her infant child, what's being stored for the future, that there's this transmission of fear, of anxiety, of terror that's traveling into this child through her deep connection with him, that he will never truly understand if he survives what he has lived through, but he will carry it in his body for the rest of his days, and he will carry that trauma. It will emerge in his adulthood. It will manifest in his behavior in ways that he doesn't understand. And so the legacies of what occurs in this book are, they become intergenerational trauma.
We see it at a point of such extremeness as society, in this case in Dublin, in a city that's very recognisable to lots of us, but also totally unreal. And I was thinking of that blend of a place that we know and the complete unreality. And it struck me that I know you've done events and so forth with Sebastian Barry, whose novel Old God's Time was long listed alongside Prophet Song. And it struck me that his book starts with policemen at the door and it blends reality and unreality. And I wondered whether you felt that that had a particular resonance in Irish culture, because I kind of found this book to be both Irish and not Irish, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about our relationship with the police in Ireland is that it's generally a very benign one. I mean, the Gardaí have been largely unarmed throughout their history. You sort of imagine when the guards call at your door that you'll be on a first-name basis with them. And it's actually there in that chat with Eilish, that initial chat, where he's just kind of just very jovial, and he's saying, oh, we'll try and warm ourselves up in the heater of the car. And she's saying, call me Eilish. And it's that sort of, that's kind of how it is until it's not. And, you know, I'm not sure what Kool-Aid myself and Sebastian are both supping on, to be honest with you, but maybe we're just channeling something from the same place. You know, in this book, the fact that we have the secret police now, that we have the GNSB, is in itself, again, something that we just don't recognize. You know, the characters say, well, we don't have the secret police in Ireland. It's something we've never had until now, which again is that sort of, just that sense of that reality is suddenly altered by a degree, a colder degree than we'd expected. And that's the way this book moves. It's the real that seems to be the real, but there's something creeping into it. And it's there in the early on that something has come into the house, something formless and yet felt. Is it like a shadow or something? And it just starts to grow and grow and grow, but it's almost invisible. It's not there until it's so enormous that it becomes what it is.
I was also interested in that idea of the formlessness of the threat. This is a kind of people's eye view. As yeah. You say, the authorities who we see, we only see in that kind of human interaction with a guard who possibly doesn't want to be doing what he or she is doing. We never see the politicians. We never know really any details of the regime, and it has that kind of timelessness and also that sort of metaphorical sense to it. That kind of plane is going on.
Yes, I give the book to some early readers, some people I really trust, and one of them, who's a very sharp reader, but he said, I think you've missed a trick here. He says, you haven't detailed the politics. There's an opportunity here to dial in the politics, because, you know, then you can make a sort of statement about that. And I thought, you're missing the point. And I didn't say it, but I thought it. You're truly missing the point. Because if I had dialed in the politics, then the book would become about that politics rather than what it actually is about. And so it's been my observation that sort of 1 in 10 critics, I don't read the reviews, but I get the tenor of them from my team. And, you know, I think 1 in 10 seem to truly miss the point. And that's fine. That's how it goes. I can't tell people how to read a book. But if I had dialed in the politics, it would be about the politics. It would be about a specific thing. If I had set the book in another country that wasn't in Ireland, it would be about that specific condition. Whereas I'm interested in the timelessness of the outcome, not the methodology. The methodology changes, the politics, there are always different formulations, but the outcome is always the same. And so you choose your lenses. And the lens that I choose to foreground in this book is the personal cost of events.
The way you get the backlash against the regime as well. So it's at some point, sort of towards the midpoint and going onwards in the book, there is this sort of this rebel army that forms and starts to push the regime back. But we don't get any, you know, hope about them through the central character, Eilish, either. These aren't the answer either. And I think what you're saying about the politics makes great sense to me, because if you were to put actual politics in it, you'd start inevitably rooting for one side or the other, or trying to...
Precisely.
And I think that was one of the wonderful things about it. The bleakness of this book is you get a sense once a country descends into this sort of tyranny, what replaces it is not necessarily going to be any better. And that seems to be the hole that, you know, so many places get themselves into. And anyway, I thought that kind of timelessness was done really beautifully.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, when you don't detail whether the book is set in the future or a counterfactual present, you're allowing yourself some mythic space to enter the novel. And I'm interested. I've always been in all my novels. I've come as close to the mythic as I can, because the closer you get, the more freight your story can carry. And I'm interested in that sense of timelessness. I'm interested in the sort of articulations of what it is that makes us human beings across time, the sort of eternal truths that I'm drilling down. And, you know, my early novels were historical fiction, which is a term I think is completely meaningless, but I use the past as a way to sort of drown out the noise of the present. So it allowed me to create space to chase after these things. And with Beyond the Sea, my fourth book, I figured out a way to pivot out of that, to chase these things within a more contemporary setting. And the Prophet Song, you know, I seem to have sort of caught something of tenor of the moment in the book. And that wasn't my goal. I'm chasing for the sort of connections that allows this book to sit in a place where it's speaking to the past, the future, and the present all at once. And I've met people from different conflicts, you know, Ukraine and Palestine, Gaza, in the last, literally this week. And they've said to me, your book speaks to my country, precisely. And I think that there's a kind of miracle in that for me as a writer sitting in Dublin, you know, in my house in Dublin, that I'm somehow managing to connect with people. But that goes back to the universalities that I'm chasing, trying to come up as close as possible to myth.
That reminds me of something that Alex said to me in an email yesterday, that actually this book reminded her of a novel by a Ukrainian novelist called Serhii Zhadan called The Orphanage, which Alex and I have both, we were judging a literary award when it won the award. I felt exactly the same way, Alex. That it spoke to that conflict like it speaks to lots of other conflicts. And I thought that was a very interesting point you made.
One of the questions that it asks, which is the question, you know, that people have asked themselves throughout history in different contexts and ways over and over again, is when do you leave? How do you leave? Should you leave? What will happen if you don't leave? And what, in a way, does leaving mean? That seems to be one of the engines that is really powering us through the book.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's something I've always been interested in, because we watch the TV and we say, oh, but geez, I would have got out. I would have got out, you know, when we look back on the Holocaust, I would have left. I would have known when to go. Really? I'm not so sure. With this book, that was one of the big questions. The sort of, again, it goes back to blindness, human blindness, philosophical blindness. How do you know? But even again, there's another layer to that. Anya in the book is phoning Eilish and she tells her, you need to leave. It's time. History is a silent record of those who did not know when to leave. And Eilish responds back, effectively saying, "That's easy for you to say. I'm enmeshed in my life. My kids, my daughter plays hockey. What about dad? You know, her father who's got dementia. What if he falls and breaks a hip? What then? You know, and Larry, of course, who's been disappeared. How can she leave when her husband has been disappeared?" So she's, isn't it the thing that I realized writing the book is that she's so completely entangled, enmeshed in relationships, in the complexity of modern life that we all are dealing with, that nobody willingly leaves that. It has to be taken away from you before you can leave. And even then you're shunted. And that's what I learned writing this book, that our relationships to the place, to family, to people are actually what define us. And that's why she always sees these moments of being throughout the book where she's lost in the now. But very often she's fine. You know, she's reflecting always on memory and meaning and people that she's related to, because that's actually what we are.
Well, I have to ask you this with the complete caveat that this is just something that happened in the world, you know, separate to your book. But, you know, a week ago, we saw violence on the streets of Dublin, and we saw a small but very determined right-wing group wanting to create pain and mayhem and fear. And I wonder how you felt about that in relation to your own work.
I live in Dublin. It's my town. It's my city. And this is in Dublin. And I was shocked when I saw it, you know. And one of my friends, he was a newspaper editor until recently, and he followed the action on his bicycle, and he took a really extraordinary photograph of a double-decker, a Dublin bus, a bus that I'm on regularly, you know, just in complete flames against the darkness. And I was, like everybody else, I was astonished. I was gutted. But at the same time, the writer was not surprised. And this is the thing. I mean, these energies are always there, and these energies are growing. And, you know, I've been observing for many years, as we all have, what I call openly an unraveling, because there are things being tolerated now that would have been intolerable 15, 20 years ago in politics, even 10 years ago, perhaps. And one plays a game of join the dots. You know, if you take sort of the opening chapter of Prophet Song and you say, let's join the dots. What does it take to get to the opening of the chapter? That's a question for the readers, perhaps, of this book. But I think it's important to say that Prophet Song is a work of fiction. I didn't set out to make a claim, a statement of prophecy about Ireland in particular, that what I was chasing, you know, always, as I said, was timelessness, the universality. And there was a quote that I wanted to use from Cormac McCarthy's The Crossing as an epigraph. And he unfortunately was dying at the time, and he passed away, and we couldn't get permission in time for publication. And it was really key to what I was aiming at. And I'll mangle it slightly, but he said the task of the narrator is a difficult one. He appears to be required to choose his tale from among the many that are possible. But of course, that is not the case. The task is rather to make many of the one.
Paul, it's an amazing novel. We are delighted for you. And thank you so much for coming on the TLS podcast to talk to us about it.
It's a great pleasure. The TLS is a tremendous institution, and it's wonderful for me to be here with you both. Thank you so much for being attentive and kind readers.
Thanks, Paul.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, Emily Copley leafs through Virginia Woolf's diaries.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. This week, we look at a story of the diaries of an extraordinary woman, lost in wartime, then rediscovered and brought to light by another extraordinary woman. And it's not just a gripping yarn, it's of literary and historical importance, since the diaries are by Virginia Woolf, and it was one of the Monuments Men, who was in fact a woman, who rescued them. Emily Copley, who writes on Virginia Woolf, has told this story and read the reissued diaries for us in the TLS this week. And we're really delighted that she can join us today. Emily, many thanks for talking to us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So this story, which I have told very briefly and not very well, it's got many layers, hasn't it? We should start unearthing them. So when did Virginia Woolf write the diaries and how were they lost?
Woolf kept diaries before her marriage to Leonard Woolf that were not regular, sort of off and on and taking various forms. And then she married Leonard Woolf in 1912. And then in 1915, she started keeping a regular diary. We don't know specifically why. And she kept this until her death in March 1941, with a quite long break during a period of severe mental illness between 1915 and 1917. But aside from that long gap, there is this continuous record of her extraordinary life and thinking, and it amounts to 30 notebooks. That is from 1915 to the end of her life, is 30 notebooks. And many of these notebooks, Virginia Woolf salvaged from her London home after it had been bombed early in the war. And she brought the notebooks to her country house, Monk's House, in Sussex. And after her death, Leonard edited about one-fifth as a selection, published as a writer's diary. This was in 1953. And then many years later, after many of the principal people whom Woolf wrote about had died, it was decided that the whole thing should be published. And that's where Anne Olivier Bell took on the job. I could say more about that, but already there's well, a structure for you.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, that's brilliant. I mean, we'll come to what the diaries were about and what they were for. But Anne Olivier Bell was also Major Popham, wasn't she?
She was.
Which sounds like an Evelyn Waugh novel.
Oh.
I was reading it and reading your piece, which is so brilliant at contextualizing the whole thing and giving you this wonderful flavour of what Woolf's writing in her diaries was like. But the first time I got to Major Popham, I thought, well, who's he? Because she just sounds like a character from a novel.
Yeah, she, Anne-Olivia Bell, wrote a wonderful booklet. It's called Editing Virginia Woolf's Diary. She wrote this, it was published about 10 years after the full diary was published. And she sort of sets out how she took on this project, what it entailed, the challenges, the reception. And she's at great pains to make clear why she was a good candidate to take on this project. She really does not want to be accused of nepotism because she was married to Quentin Bell, the nephew of Virginia Woolf, that is Vanessa Bell's son, the surviving son. And so in this pamphlet, and you know, one could learn elsewhere as well, she gives us her credentials. She was a trained art historian. She was extremely meticulous as a scholar. She had tremendous expertise in sorting artwork, including stolen artwork right after the war. She mounted exhibitions. She accompanied artworks on journeys to various shows. She had a scholarly and art historical training that strongly aided her in the project.
So she does seem to have been the perfect person. And actually, the nepotism in this case, you'd have thought would be helpful because she would know something of what the family was like and how they operated.
Exactly. And she says that as well. She says, you know, I know these people. They were my friends. They're my family. I know the social world. I know the history. I understand their humor. It is a great boon, in fact, yes, that she is connected.
Mm. So now they've been reissued again, haven't they? Complete with the original notes with forwards by contemporary writers. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
Right. And do the contemporary writers sort of say anything new about it, or?
They're lovely forewords that are really appreciations for the given volume. You know, there are five volumes. Each foreword sort of champions its volume. What is unique about this time in Woolf's life, or about the particular experiments of this diary in this volume? Adam Phillips focuses on psychoanalysis a bit. You know, each writer focuses on what draws them. They call our attention. Each forward calls our attention to particularly salient quotes or tangles of that particular volume, I would say.
I was really interested to see that Margot Jefferson had written one of the introductions, or the introduction for one of the volumes, because she is such an extraordinarily interesting memoirist herself, Jefferson, because she sort of manages to bring in so much social and political detail, but understand this idea of trying to write the self and write the body. And it seems to kind of go to the, that just seems like a sort of marriage made in heaven in a way.
It is. And she has arguably the hardest task among the five writers of forewords, because she makes a case for the diary when Woolf published writing is not so well known. The early 30s, the diary of the early 30s. So this is Woolf's novel, The Waves, was published in 31. Then Woolf is at work on a famous essay, A Letter to a Young Poet. And then after that, 33, 34, not much well-known is published. And Woolf is working on two massive projects, well, one massive project that results in two books, Three Guineas and The Years. But for several years, there's nothing famous that Woolf is publishing. So Margot Jefferson has to defend, why should we be interested in a diary of years that are not artistically so famous? And she does an excellent job for showing, you know, a diary is revealing not only of the most dramatic moments, but also, this is her phrase, I quote it in my review, a diary is a record also of, quote, the states between the pinnacle and the chasm. Just sort of everyday life, daily challenges, what happens between the drama, the dramatic moments. So I thought she did an excellent job.
Mm. I mean, let's talk about what we find in the diaries. We don't, as you say, we don't really know why she started them. Do you think they were for herself, or with an eye on posterity, or to feed into her work, or a bit of all of those, or none of them? What do you think?
All of them and more. Certainly, she had an eye on posterity. She knew that her diary might be published. She loved reading others' published diaries. She read so many of them that three books have been written, a trilogy by Barbara Lounsbery, specifically on the diaries that Woolf read as she was keeping her own diary. So Woolf was fascinated with others' diaries. and was sort of seeing herself contributing to that canon of great diaries. So certainly she has an eye on posterity. I think her biggest audience is herself, but a projected future self. She often refers to old Virginia and is, you know, she needs a sense of an audience, but the audience can be herself in some sort of, you know, projected superego. And so she's often saying, well, what would interest old Virginia? Should I record this? Should I record that? She has a sense that old Virginia will want to mine these diaries for a memoir. But in practice, current Virginia is doing that all the time, mining the diaries for whichever work she's working on. And even through her life, you know, reading the diaries, you hear passages, you think, isn't that familiar? Oh, actually, she used that in To the Lighthouse, or oh, she used that in her last essay, Anon. Oh, so she clearly is rereading her diaries throughout her life and drawing on them.
That's very moving. Is future Virginia, when she's old, looking back and reading them, is it?
That's right, yes.
So, which obviously never happened. But though, as you say, current Virginia was doing that work the whole time anyway.
Right.
One of the things that I found so intriguing in a piece full of intrigue was that her diaries did take separate paths at one point. She eventually kind of kept two sets of diaries, one that was more expansive and the other was more detailed and specific. And that's largely to do with her cataloguing what she sees around her every day, and particularly in the natural world, isn't it? And I wondered if that in any way kind of gave a sense of her trying to find different outlets for different parts of her mind, trying to compartmentalize in a way that would make them feel contained on the page, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right. If you sit down with volume one and you just start reading, you're going to come up short on page 44. I'm checking. The diary just stops. So you're on page 44 and there it is, it just stops. You think, wait, what happens? And then it skips 2 years. And the diary starts up again, and it sounds totally different. You get really previously, you know, you sit down to read, you open it up, and it's conversational and long and descriptive and chatty. And then, okay, it stops page 44. Then it skips 2 years. And then on page 48, you start reading again, and we get these really short entries that are purely observing nature. There is no first person. Sentences start with a verb. Saw this. Went out to Lewis. Heard blah, blah, blah. The I has been lopped off. And the content is very much natural observation. And we get a note explaining that Wolf had a serious breakdown for these 2 years, off and on. So you think, well, this is clearly a convalescent, you know, trying to pick up the pen again. But in fact, she had been writing a tremendous amount. Letters, her experimental short story, The Mark on the Wall, part of her second novel. So I don't think it's only that. I think it's also, as you've just said, that it's an experiment. It's a new experiment. Let's try this new approach to a diary, natural history notes. Let's see what happens.
But then she ends up doing the other sort again, doesn't she? Right. Kind of alongside.
Yes, yes, that was right. That was the other part of your question. So she keeps this natural history diary for a while when she's in her country house. And then when she goes to her London house, she leaves the natural history diary behind in the country house. And back in London, she resumes what the diary initially sounded like, you know, expansive, chatty, lively, long entries full of metaphor, full of the first person, recording conversations, ideas, writing projects. It's very thick and dense and vivacious. And then when she returns to the country house, she keeps both diaries at the same time. And what is special about this new edition by Granta is that we can compare the two simultaneous diaries. Anne Olivier Bell had omitted the overlap in her edition and had published the overlapping diary separately in a periodical called the Charleston Magazine, which is now pretty hard to access. So what's terrific about this edition is that you can compare, you can flip back and forth to compare the simultaneous diaries and see, well, what, you know, what did she use the one diary for and what the other? And is there a trajectory? I mean, finally, the natural history diary just stops. I think she gets bored with it. The other diary, you know, subsumes it.
But it's so brilliant, isn't it? The way that she writes about, I mean, one of my favorite lines that, I mean, you quote so many wonderful lines, many of which could be, you know, titles for a memoir like Embarrassing at Breakfast or something like that, which is what she says about Vita Sackville-West after she's been to stay, embarrassing at breakfast.
Aren't we all?
But then, exactly. Then there are these kind of marvelous moments when she's looking at the natural, you know, she's lying on the side of a hollow, I think you quote, waiting for Leonard to come and pick mushrooms with her. And she sees a hare and she thinks, this is earth life. And it's just such a kind of four words that make you understand why she could, what it meant to her. And then she goes on to say she thinks of herself as an evolved kind of hare, as if a moon visitor saw me. I mean, they are so beautifully written and so suggestive.
Yeah. Yeah, she has this tremendous empathy and imaginative generosity, which in this passage extends, you know, to alien life forms. You know, what would it be to be in the mind of a moon man, you know, moon woman? And so it's, this passage is, as you say, it's very beautiful. It's also funny. And it also attests to this, to an empathy she extends, you know, more typically to other people, but throughout the diary we have that she gives us, she's always trying to understand from other people's perspective, and so she'll record people's stories that they tell her at great length, sometimes perfect strangers, or record what people ate for breakfast, speaking of embarrassing at breakfast, she's always very interested in breakfast, you know, she's trying to understand what is this person's point of view, what is that person's point of view, and then in this passage it reaches this sort of apogee, a moon visitor's perception.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There is a claim. So say this edition is very valuable because you can look at both of those diaries alongside. Am I right that you're not quite convinced by the claim that they're completely unexpurgated?
Oh, there are two.
There's a question.
I want to say this diary is an extraordinary public good. We should all be tremendously grateful that it's back in print. It is all to the... I don't like the word unexpurgated, which is sensational. And Wolfe's life has often been regarded as sensational. And so I don't think that does her or her work or us, her readers, a service. It's also the case that not everything that Anne Olivia Bell omitted has been reinstated. She omitted very little. So she omitted initially the overlapping Country House diary, which she then published later on. And she omitted really a handful of passages concentrated in the last volume that are particularly cutting, written of people whom Anne Olivia Bell was close to and was trying to protect. And so, as well as certain passages concerning sexual pursuits and flirtations. So I am grateful to have as much as possible what Wolfe wrote. And so I appreciate that certain passages have been reinstated, but not quite everything has. And I feel kind of crummy, you know, saying, well, I really wish I knew the name of, you know, the three people who were in bed together in that passage. I really don't care. I really think it's fine to be discreet about certain things. And so I don't want to be someone saying, well, it should be, you know, published absolutely, absolutely in full. Or the names of certain men who were at the male baths. Mm. It's okay, they can be left out, but then the claim of unexpurgated is not quite true.
I see what you mean. So, I mean, it's fine to be discreet, but then don't say unexpurgated as though there are all sorts of salacious things in there.
Yeah, and the word makes one, such as myself, want to go through and see what has been reinstated, what had been left out and what has been reinstated, and it doesn't feel good, you know, it doesn't feel good morally, aesthetically, to be looking for names to be reinstated in passages about sexual adventures. It just, that's not what Wolfe's diary is. That's not the use of it.
Sure. Okay, so wonderful thing, and we should just ignore the unexpurgated. Forget about that.
Exactly, there you go. It's advertising.
Chuck that out the window.
Forget it, and everyone should buy this and read it and be grateful to all the editors.
Finally, as Alex says, there is wonderful stuff in there. She says, she writes in it, you quote her as saying that she writes in the diary when she's in the dumps and the dismals, which is her phrase for it. But there are moments of just, as you said, wonderful kind of insight and empathy and beauty. I wondered if you might read us the quote that you give at the end that she says about being hypnotized by the world.
Yeah, this is on her father's birthday in 1928. And she writes, "So the days pass, and I ask myself sometimes whether one is not hypnotized as a child by a silver globe, by life. I should like to take the globe in my hands and feel it quietly, round, smooth, heavy, and so hold it day after day."
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Emily, for talking us through those wonderful histories and diaries and through the whole process. Thank you so much.
Oh, it has been a pleasure. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Paul Lynch, Emily Copley and Toby Lischnig.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye